I'm George Steinmetz. I'm a photographer.
No mistaking what this in fact really is. It's a massive voice of protest against the rule of the Shah.
Good evening. Now we know the United States has passed the word to the Shah of Iran. It's time for him to leave his country.
The political initiative now lies totally with the Ayatollah. Now that he's back, he'll very soon announce the establishment of a government of his own.
There might have been tears in the eyes of the Shah as he left Iran for what could be the last time. There was nothing but sheer delight on the faces of the demonstrators who took to the streets of the capital in their thousands to celebrate the departure of the man they have hated for so long.
I'm George Steinmetz. I'm a photographer. For the past 15 years, I've focused on all the world's extreme deserts. It's very low, kind of three-dimensional, kind of almost humanistic aerial photograph. And I became fascinated with desert environments because they're very beautiful. It's like the earth with its living skin peeled away, and you can see all the things that have shaped the earth and the history of the earth, like in ancient cities and old river courses and earthquake faults, and it's all laid bare. The kind of aircraft I use is kind of unusual. It's a motorized paraglider. It's the lightest and slowest aircraft in the world, and you run to take off and land. The motor is a little backpack. I think it looks kind of like a leaf blower. And then the wing is, it's a parachute style wing. And I don't need an airfield to take off or land. And I went to Iran, I think it was 2004. To photograph the salt deserts in southern Iran, from the areas south from Tehran down to Chabahar on the Indian Ocean. The landscape there is fascinating to me, and also the ancient culture and how the people have adapted to living there is very interesting to me. And so I spent about 6 weeks in the Republic. I had a difficult time because of my nationality. But I had a civilian permit. I didn't have a military permit, but I had a civilian permit, and it was kind of like there were these two warring parts of the government, and I was like a little piece of paper flying around between the two of them.
Thank you.
They could also get me a permit to fly. I wanted to go there with my own personal aircraft and take aerial photographs. And I don't think anybody had taken aerial photographs, like no foreigner taken aerial photographs in Iran since before the revolution. Well, I really wanted to photograph all the world's deserts, and Iran has some of the most fascinating desert terrain in the world. It has some of the best salt domes in the world, and the Yardangs, these wind-eroded rock formations, are fantastic. And I think that people who are helping me, the travel company, my fixture, they understood that. But for the government, they just couldn't understand why some American would come over here to photograph a bunch of rocks and salt. Didn't make any sense. Like, they had this thought, he must be a spy. This is all just to cover the thing. This guy's got to be a spy. Well, I remember, even in America, Iran is not perceived in a very positive light. I mean, because of the hostage crisis when Jimmy Carter was president, and all the political doings of the government, it's not the most people are. When you go to Iran from America, people, it's like, it's serious. It's like you're especially that we have no embassy there. If you get in trouble, there's nobody to get you out of trouble. And I remember when I went to arrived in Tehran, I had to go and get, they had to fingerprint me like I was a criminal. I was the only passenger who arrived who was like taken aside. And went to this little room and they wanted to take all my fingerprints and go through all my stuff. And then finally they let me go. And I had, you know, I had my aircraft with me and all these cameras and radios and GPS and all this stuff. And they just let me go right through. And I thought, wow, this is amazing. And I got to the hotel, and I remember I called up my wife, and I said, you won't believe this. You won't believe I got through. I'm here. And it was really quite miraculous. And it took about 3 days to get all our stuff together and leave Tehran. But I was, once I got past that, initial barrier, people were wonderful. Everything was great. I mean, numerous times, I was given extraordinary hospitality. People would take us in. You go up to, a nomad in the desert, and he will, give you his last goat. He'll slaughter his last goat to give you hospitality. And even in Shaddad, when I wanted to go out to the loot, we arrived there, and they held us up for a couple of days for permits. But the governor or the mayor, he invited us into his house for lunch. I'm somebody who likes challenges. I'm the kind of person, if somebody says, you can't do that, then all of a sudden it becomes the first thing on my list. And so with Iran, it was the attraction of the geography, and also the fact that nobody really goes there. It makes me want to go. Madashti Lut is, many people believe, is the hottest, driest place in the world. And so it's a place I really had to go. I had no choice. I went to Iran in the fall of 2003, and I wanted to go and explore the deserts and the salt basins in the south. And one of the most interesting was the Dasht-e Lut in the south of the country. And we started in Kerman. Fascinating to me is you can see, and this is a satellite image from Google Earth. You have this. This is a field of yardings. This is wind eroded rock formations, and the winds there, they come out of the northwest, and they blow in only one direction and extremely strong for many months of the year. And they come down, and then they hit the bottom of the basin, and they turn and they drop their sand over here to the east. And so the winds are there. There's a big wind, and then it just kind of turns and drops. And this has all been excavated by the blowing wind. And the geologists call these formations yardangs. The yardangs in Iran is the biggest yardang field in the world. The only other place you find these besides, you find them on Mars. You find them on Earth and Mars, but only in dry areas, primarily in old lake beds with very soft sand and very strong winds. And what I wanted to do is to go out and take aerial photos of the yardangs. The locals call them kaluts. And so I flew in three areas. I flew right near Shaddad, and I did some flying up here in the north. I was also able to go around to the south and go up into the dune area on the southern end of the yardangs. When you're out there, it's a very strange feeling. I felt like I was kind of an ant crawling across the back of a crocodile, because the kaluts, they look almost like the skin on a reptile, but just seen with a microscope. Working on this book about all the world's deserts. This Wüsten von oben means desert from above. It's the German edition. And I wanted to photograph all of the world's deserts. And this is actually the section from Iran. This is out in the Dasht-e Kavir. I think that's in Kerman. It's down near Bandar Abbas. We had a lot of problems. This is out in the Kavir. We keep getting stuck in the mud. They call it charbe. It's like this greasy mud. When I was out in the Dasht-e Kavir, I had a couple crashes and I broke three fingers in my hand. This finger's never going to be quite straight, so I had to get x-rayed by the local hospital. This is my fixer, Masoud Mubassari, who got me in and out of trouble many, many times. Anyway, so I was working on this book, and it's a compilation of pictures from every extreme desert in the world, and you find these desert environments on virtually every continent, including Antarctica. And Iran was one of the most fascinating places. But this is for example, this is in the Dasht-e Kavir, and nobody's ever been out there. This is right near the military rocket range, south of Iran. So this is a model of my aircraft that was made for me by a young man in Africa, and the glider is it's three parts. There's a harness and the motor in your back, and then the wing overhead. And when I want to take pictures, I have to let go of the brake lines that lead up to the trailing edge of the wing, and then I'll take pictures for a few minutes, and then I've got to
actually get back to business of flying the aircraft. And I can fly anywhere from 10 meters above the ground to I've flown as much as 2,000 meters above takeoff. And it's flown from 400 meters below sea level in the Dead Sea to 4,000 meters above sea level in the Andes and the Himalaya. With the glider, you can, because you're hanging underneath the wing, it's self-stabilizing. If you get into a little turbulence, it's like a playground swing, and it will stabilize itself. And so you can take pictures for a few minutes and let go of the controls, and it will fly straight. I have right here, my hands are up, and I'm holding on to the line, they call the brake lines, that go to the trailing edge of the wing, and it's much like pulling flaps in a plane. So if I pull left, I pull this down, and this part of the wing slows down, and then I turn left. If I pull right, I turn right. And so, but if I don't pull at all, then generally it'll fly straight. So I would get set up, for example, over the Yardang field, and the winds there were so strong when I was flying there, I was almost like just stuck in the sky. The wind was blowing at my flight speed. So once I would take off, I would advance a little bit and I get up high, and then all of a sudden I can't move, and then as I go higher, I would start to be flying backwards into the wind, which is very frightening, actually. It's kind of dangerous. When I was in southern Iran, one of the places I really wanted to go to was Bam. It's has one of the, well, at the time it was the largest piece of mud architecture in the world, and a World Heritage Site. And I wanted to photograph from the ground, but especially from the air, because it's very rarely done. And after I got home, like the day after Christmas, the earthquake hit. And you know, thousands of people were killed in Bam, and I was reading about it in the paper about, you know, the disaster and the people who were killed. And it curiously mentioned that there were a couple of Americans killed. Like in Iran, for example, I flew over Bam. I was flew over Bam 2 weeks before it was destroyed in an earthquake. But I could see the plan of the city in a way that would be very difficult for you to understand from the ground. I talked National Geographic into doing a big story in the Sahara, and I wanted to do a lot of aerial photos to help people understand the landscape. And I'd lined up, before I made the proposal, I'd found a bush pilot who had an ultralight that we could use in Niger. And then when I got the magazine to agree to the project, I called him up and he said he had a better job, he couldn't do it. And so I had to find a way. I had money from the magazine to do this project, but I had no aircraft, so I had to figure out something I could do on my own. And people told me about this kind of flying, and I thought they were crazy at first. To the idea of me piloting and taking pictures at the same time, I thought was very dangerous. But when I looked into it and found people who had actually done it, they said it was reasonable, as long as I only flew early in the morning and late in the day when the air is calm. And that's the same thing I did in Iran. We only fly for the first 2 hours in the morning, maybe the last hour of the afternoon. And the rest of the time it was too dangerous to fly.
But after we left, like 2 weeks after I got home, there was the earthquake hit, and the city was destroyed, and thousands of people were killed. And I was reading, there was one American guy who was killed in Bam, and he was actually killed in bed in the same hotel, the same bed that I was sleeping in. What happened was a ceiling fan, and the ceiling collapsed, and it impaled him, like, you know, the ceiling fan, like, killed him. And that was the same bed that I was sleeping in, the same fan. It's just weird, like, you know, you do these things that are kind of dangerous, and then, you know, you get lucky and somebody else wasn't so lucky. Kavir, and I knew from research that there's a lot of mud flats we had to go across, and it's very easy to get stuck in the mud. So we had welded special things called sand ladders, which we couldn't find in Iran. And it's kind of like a small ladder made out of metal that you put underneath the tires, so that if you get stuck in the mud, you can kind of like basically climb out on this ladder made of steel out of the mud. And those ended up being very, very useful to us because we got out on the Kavir. And I wanted to go into areas with interesting geology, but they were far off the road. And so we'd be driving cross country across the mud flats. And you're going, and all of a sudden you start hearing mud spatter in the tires, and you slow down and you stop and you're stuck, and you can get up to your axle in mud. And it was nasty. We got stuck out there for literally days at a time. The kind of the pictures I got, I'm not trying to brag, but the pictures I got, aerial photos of the landscape, are things that no one's ever done before, and it's really quite a privilege. It was a privilege I had to earn through a lot of patience and hard work and risk taking, but it was an extraordinary view of a country in a way that no one's ever seen it before, and it's a spectacularly beautiful country. I was surprised at the, you know, I think in the Western press, a lot of people in the Middle East, Arab people and Muslim people, they're kind of seen as the bad guys, you know, especially like after September 11. But there's this kind of like, you know, you can't trust them, and there's a lot of that sentiment, and pervasive in the United States. And when I got over there, it was just that I was surprised at how sophisticated and open the people were, and they're very curious. I remember, like, my fixer, he was all upset when he found out the Bee Gees had broken up, and it was like he was trapped in this like 1970s mentality when the country's more open, and it's just. It's kind of like, to me, it is like a bit like Romeo and Juliet, where they have these two people that should get along really well, but their parents say it's not allowed. No, I would love to go back to Iran. Of all the countries I went to on this odyssey, I was in 27 countries over 15 years. If there's one country I could go back to, the first would be Iran. I just find it fascinating. The ancient culture, the ruins, the people, the landscape was just extraordinary.